So minority is really an important factor in terms of how our community communicates and listens. So listening is the biggest part, and finding ways to bring forward those really out in the left field, so to speak, kinds of ideas and voices. So Nauken-Wiik describes that. It's a process in our community that describes a process that makes that happen. We use it in our governance process. We use it in our community dialogues. When we use it in our family circles, our extended family meetings. And the idea isn't to make decisions. The idea is to hear all of the different aspects, all of the different views. So in Nauken-Wiik, we actually set up a dynamic in which that can happen, and in a dynamic which understands that there are polarities in community because there's diversity. And one of the ways we do that is we try to take the polarities in their larger sense, and we give them context in the community, and we give them authority in terms of that context in the community, which can't be usurped by any other area of community. I'll just describe those four to you that we use in our community. What could be described in our language is something similar to your idea of the elders, maybe. Although that's not really a correct term in our language, it means those who have had long experience, and it doesn't mean in years. It really means the teachings from the generations and generations and generations past. So you could be part of that group even if you're 20 years old or 10 years old or 30 years old. It's the knowledge that has been passed on to you and that you express and stand for that makes you in our language. And so your thinking and your concerns and your responsibilities are directed towards making sure that everything is remembered that is necessary to make things continue on in a healthy way. That group is usually directly polarized against the group that could be described as the youth, the younger generation, the young people. We think of those in our language as not only people that are young, but people that have a really great urge for innovation and creativity and new things, new ideas, new concepts. And that's always a dynamic that's really needed in any community, in any society, and really encourage, just as the elders and their bringing forward of all their teachings and immense knowledge is really encouraged. But those are the two that's usually a source of oppositional dynamics. So one part of our Nauken-Wiik is a real clear process in which those two speak to each other, to inform each other, and to clarify for each other. Part of our process for discussion in that Nauken-Wiik process is to something real simple. You start with a concept that if there is a problem or a crisis or something that we're trying to resolve that we don't understand, if anybody in this room already has all the answers and already knows it all, then they should have resolved it. Well, you know, why not? You know? So therefore, what that means then, nobody has all the answers. No one person should be arguing for their view, their position, their rightness, or whatever. What it means then, everyone should be listening to try to understand what the other is saying, and to try to incorporate into the overall solution what everyone is saying, so that what everyone is saying, if it's brought together, will make more sense than what I'm saying. And obviously, I didn't resolve it, so what I'm saying isn't that important in terms of by itself. So that premise to begin with is a way in which we create the dialogue. We tell people, you're not here to debate. You're not here to enforce your agenda. You're not here to convince me of what you think. You're here to listen and to hear the most diverse and opposite view to yours, and to understand where it's coming from and why it's there and why that opinion is important in terms of how we make a solution. You are responsible for doing that. You are responsible for hearing what is the most opposite to your opinion and finding a way to try to incorporate the other's diversity, the other's difference, and embrace that in terms of what we collectively make as a solution, so that that difference is no longer a difference. It becomes part of what we are and who we are. And so in terms of the other two dynamics that exist in the community, there's what we call, in our language, iskaltmih, the male. In our language, we don't have, in our pronoun structure, we don't have a word that is like he or she. And it's quite a difficult thing to speak English language, because everything is sort of, you know, gender sort of based in that way. And I talked with my mother about it, my aunt, Jeanette, who I'm named after, and both are medicine women, and asked them, well, how come we don't have that? And my aunt looked at me and she said, well, it has nothing to do with the person. You know, what does it have to do with the person? And she said, if you were to say he or she in our language, you'd have to point to their genitals. You know, you'd have to point to what's between the legs. She said, and why would you do that? Why would you talk about a person and point between their legs? You know, she said, it doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't. It doesn't. People are what they do and who they relate to and how they relate to the world. And it has nothing to do with gender, except that there's males and females. So the word is more like male and female. Skaltmih and tkismilh. The word skaltmih actually has to do with how we understand in our philosophy how things work in the world. I guess you'd say the cosmology of things. The way that the word it's constructed for the male is the spreading outward of life as human, the spreading outward of our life form as human. That's the word that we use for male. Tamih is the spreading outward of the life, diversity of life on the land. And for the male, it's skaltmih, meaning the one who's able to dream and able to spread outward the life of the human. And so that aspect or that idea of procreation and the male and the energy behind that is understood as a part of what the male is. And in the same way, the female, the word for female in our language is tkismilh. And it actually is a really interesting word in terms of what I heard here earlier today. The idea of the separating of the part of the skin of the community, the separation into family is tkismilh. That understanding of tklem means separating out, and milh is the covering of the community, the skin of the community. That's the whole of the people, the family systems, in other words. So when the family system and which is represented by the female, and the male, which is represented by how the land operates, intersect. The work that has to be done to create balance is to make sure that there's clear understanding between those two dynamics. How the how the family and people in the family are related to each other based on how they feel about each other, how they treat each other. What society is about feeling, how we care about one another, how we love one another, how we protect one another, how we need to make sure there's food for everyone, how we need to make sure that everyone has, you know, warmth and shelter, and how everyone is nurtured emotionally, how you make people feel good, how you celebrate. All of those aspects are what is understood to be under that tkismiluh, that female. And the other aspects of the tmich, the land, the understanding of that is that all of the things that are structurally on the land, all of the living things and all of the things that are required to make shelter, to get food, to develop all kinds of ways and organizing for that and doing that, are all about how things are done, how things get done. In other words, the actions that it takes. So it's action-based. That's why that's spreading out in that word. Everything becomes an action that has to be undertaken, that has to be done. When actions are undertaken and when they're done, they have consequences. In other words, what you do impacts people, right? And if you do things without thinking and understanding and knowing how it impacts people, you can do a lot of things that are destructive, and you do a lot of things that are destructive, thinking that you're doing it in the name of good or the name of providing and the name of prosperity. And if the male aspect gets, you know, its way, that's what it'll do. It'll just keep doing that, because that's what in our society we think of as patriarchy, right? The patriarchal model is where, you know, it doesn't matter that there's people starving. It doesn't matter that there's people hurting. It doesn't matter that there's minorities that are voiceless, you know, that are not being included, that are being excluded. As long as we keep this thing going, so some of the people can get good out of it and some of the people can get privilege out of it. And so that part, I think, is really one of the dynamics that you're talking about here, as well as the other two dynamics, but the dynamic of the male and the female aspects of community, where nurturing and caring for and providing for the feelings, the generations to come, are part of the doing continuously, and that there's clear understanding and there's cooperation and collaboration between both. I'm getting close to what I'm going to end up with here in terms of family systems. That kind of dialogue we call an aukanwih. You cannot sit down and have in our community any kind of rational decision or any kind of rational action unless you include all of those four aspects of dialogue in a deep listening process. If you do, you're endangering the whole community. If you do, you're excluding parts of the community. And in doing that, you are taking a vast risk for the next generations. And I think that's something that, for me, really resonates here, in that we think about how we can continuously give our view, our diverse view, our most opposite opinion, and we think about how we have to listen for the others and how we have to be responsible in putting that together. In terms of the family systems, there is two things that operate within community that I think is important to mention here before I finish here. One is the idea that family systems, like the community, is a living organism. We think about it as a body, a whole family system as a body, and that it's incomplete if that whole family system isn't intact. The nuclear family isn't what I'm talking about. The extended family of 3-4 generations, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandmas, grandpas, great-grandmas, grand-aunts, and so on, as the repository of a whole lot of skills in terms of how to do community, how to be community, and how to be community on the land in terms of how you treat the land and how you take care of it and how you take care of each other without destroying it and how you move that along. And so family systems, if they're fragmented into non-family systems, because I don't count a nuclear family as a family. It's a mother and father and children. And even they don't stay together in this society. There's a diaspora because of the market economy. You have to move over here for a job. You have to move over there or around the other end of the world. And so family really doesn't exist. It does not exist. There's a yearning for it and a hunger for it and a need for it, a much deeper need than we think and that we know. In terms of our indigenous community, family is survival, is the basis of survival. And you cannot operate community without family. Community doesn't exist without extended family systems. Otherwise, it's just a collection of strangers, people that are not cooperating, not collaborating, not loving each other, not taking care of each other over generations and generations and learning how to do that on the land. So there's no communities either. And so one of the things about giving, and I'll give you some quick examples about that in family systems. Our family systems in our communities are like clan systems. And each family system, extended family system, usually has a role of work in the community. Just like maybe something like the long ago, the guilds in Europe, where you had the bakers and the millers and, you know, so on and so on. And huge families passed down that, you know, skill to the next family, and they used that skill to contribute to the community. Well, in our system, those extended families are the repositories of different kinds of skills. There are medicine families, there are the healer families. Medicine families and healer families usually are similar, but one you could say are biologist, ethnobotanist, the healer families. The medicine families are the psychologists, psychiatrists, part of the chief's family belongs to that because they have to be psychologists and psychiatrists. And the chief's families, and then the people that are hunter families or fishermen or basket makers and so on, those families all have people in them that are conversant with all of those different tools that our community needs to continue on its life cycles. One of the things about gift giving in ours is we're very similar in our traditions to the West Coast tradition in that we have a huge number of feasts during the year. My mother was a longhouse leader, a winter dance leader, we call it in our community, because of course we don't have big cedars like the West Coasters, so we have short houses. And we have winter dances in the winter time. And winter dances are similar to the smokehouse, big house dances on the West Coast in that they're giveaways. And I grew up with my uncle being a medicine man, my mother being a medicine woman, and a winter house leader, dance leader. All of our extended families spent all year long, cousins, aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, children, grandchildren, gathering and making and putting aside things that are to be given away during that winter dance. And every year during that winter dance, your mother gives away everything she owns. And without question, without choosing, without deciding who it's to be given to, it's simply given in a 10-day ritual of dance. And that I saw all my life. And I was brought up with all my life. We were told by my mother, my grandmother, my aunts, and my uncles that that giving is the only way to be human. That if you don't know that giving is essential to survival, then you haven't been civilized yet. That you don't know how to be human yet. And that we're told that once we understand, when we're growing up, when we're like 2 or 3 years old, the very first things we're taught is to give in those ceremonies. The very first things that we're shown how to do is to give. That when we receive something that we really cherish and we really like and we really care about, that's the first thing we should give. Because our community is to be cherished on that level. Our people and our land is to be cherished on that level. And if you don't know how to give like that, you're poor. You're in poverty. You might hoard all the things that you think your family or your community or your business needs, but you're poor. My mother used to drive through some of the cities, and she'd look out there and she'd say, those poor people. And she meant it. She wasn't being ironic or sarcastic. She was pointing out what they were missing out on. She was pointing out what they are hungry for and what they're trying to find in accumulating and hoarding and being selfish. She was pointing out what is really, really given to you when you reverse that, and what you feel when you give. You all know that feeling. When you give of purity, you all know how good it makes you feel and how great it makes you as a person inside. You all know that feeling. That is a natural feeling to us as humans. That is the real feeling of being human. And we all feel that when we do that. Christmas time, everybody's so excited about getting and giving and giving, you know, and some people go overboard. Where do you think that feeling comes from? When we give to our loved ones, you know, we're used to just giving to our favorite chosen loved ones in this outer society. Without realizing that you feel the same in giving, whether it's your direct blood relative or whether it's a stranger absolutely not known to you, the feeling is the same. And in one of our laws, we're told that when we start understanding that principle and we start working with that principle and we source that principle, we lead our lives by giving continuously, never ever thinking about what you get back from it or exchanging it for something that you want somebody to do for you. In fact, that's not called giving in our language. In our language, that's called something else. We call it kamila. There's no word for greed in our language that I could... I've tried to find a word for greed in our language, and there isn't a word. What we found instead is that word kamila, and we use it to mean a person that... is expecting to get something back or expecting to have more than another and expecting to eat more than another, you know. And we describe people as becoming that, and we call them an esnashkailukten in our language. And what that means is a destructor of people, destroyer of people. In our traditions, we had a way to be able to describe that, because what kamila means is to be able to stop the giving. Ka means to stop, and mil means to give. You give out. It goes out to wherever it goes. Ka mila means to stop the giving, to put an obstacle between the giving and yourself. And so we describe a person as kamila if they want more for themselves, or they want more for their family, or if they, you know, in some way act as an obstacle by being selfish to the rest of everybody getting what, you know, is necessary and needed and deserved by them. In terms of someone's talk on languages here, I want to tell you that my language is one of the languages that's on the brink of extinction. And these words that I'm describing to you are immensely important words that belong in the understanding of our humanity, and that are necessary and needed in the understanding of what needs to be done to change. And in our way, we're not, we are always told not to ask for anything. We're always told in our community as a practice that when you start asking for something, that's when you're agreeing that people are being irresponsible in not understanding what your need is, not seeing what your need is, and not making sure that they have moved their resources and their actions toward making sure that need isn't there. Because that's the responsibility of people that surround you. So you in our community, you cannot ask. You cannot go to a person and say, I want you to do this for me, I want you to do that for me. All you can do is clarify for them what is happening and what the consequences are in your family or your community or on your land. Clarify for them and clarify for them what needs to be done and how it needs to be done, and then it's up to them. And if they fall short of that responsibility, that at some point they will face the same need themselves, that they will be in that kind of need. And we're told on a spiritual level that when we give, and you can try this in your own life, when you give freely without asking for anything back, whatever it might be, especially the things that are really difficult for you to give, that you receive back the equivalent of four times whatever it is that you gave. And a simple exercise that my mother used to tell me. She used to tell me, whatever you have to work now to in order to put food on the table, whatever you work for, you keep, you know, a small amount, enough to put food on the table and enough to get you back and forth to work, and you give all the rest away. And you make sure you continue to do that every year, and you'll never have to worry about your work. You'll never have to worry about, you know, all of the things that you need to cover that. And I never have. And I do that every year of my life, all the time, to my community, to my people, to strangers, to everything that I do. If I were asked to come here to speak on this topic without the giving of the organizers here, and I saw that it was something that could be given to change the way things happen, I would find a way to give that. And I would find a way to come here to do that. And I have done that and practiced that. And I think that's something that is needed in terms of how we do things. I think that's something that needs to be understood in terms of our personal. So I've taken it from the land to the community to the family to the personal level. It comes down to each person embodying that and practicing that and doing that without let up. It comes down to each person being human in that way. Thank you.
Jeanette Armstrong speaking at the 2004 conference on the gift economy in Las Vegas. See www.gifteconomyconference.com. Thanks to Frieda Burden of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service, wings.org.
My name is Scooter, and you're listening to The Inner Side, produced at KPFT Houston. When we left off last week in our story, The Mysterious Stranger by Mark Twain, all hell had broken loose in 16th century Eseldorf, where Satan was vacationing, having been cast out of heaven for a while. I slipped out of our home and set my course for Margaret's to see what was happening there. I met many people, but none of them greeted me. It ought to have been surprising, but it wasn't. for they were so distraught with fear and dread that they were not even in their right minds, I think. They were white and haggard and walked like persons in a dream, their eyes open but seeing nothing, their lips moving but uttering nothing, clasping and unclasping their hands without knowing it. At Margaret's, it was like a funeral. She and Wilhelm sat together on the sofa but said nothing, not even holding hands. Both were steeped in gloom, and Margaret's eyes were red from crying. She said, "I've been begging him to go and save himself. I cannot bear to be his murderer. The house is bewitched, and no inmate will escape the fire. But he won't go, and he'll be lost with the rest." Wilhelm said he wouldn't go. If there was danger for her, his place was by her. Then she began to cry again, and it was all so mournful, and I wished I hadn't come. There was a knock, and Satan came in, fresh and cheery, and brought that winning atmosphere of his. He never said a word about what had been happening, nor about the awful fears which were freezing the blood in the hearts of the community, but began to talk and rattle on about all manner of pleasant things, and next about music, which cleared away the remnant of Margaret's depression and brought her interest awake. She had not heard anyone talk so well and so knowingly on the subject before, and what she was feeling lit up her face and came out in words. Wilhelm noticed it and didn't look as pleased as he ought to have been. And next, Satan branched off into poetry and recited some, and Margaret was charmed again, and again, Wilhelm was not pleased as he ought to have been, and this time Margaret noticed it and was remorseful. I fell asleep to pleasant music that night. The patter of rain upon the panes and the dull growling of distant thunder. The way in the night, Satan came and roused me and said, "Come with me." Then there was a fierce glare of sunlight, and he said, "This is China." That was a grand surprise. It was so much, much further than anyone in our village had ever been, including Bartel Sperling, who had such a great opinion of his travels. It was wonderful. We sat upon a mountain, commanding a vast landscape of mountain range and gorge and valley and plain and river, with cities and villages, and a glimpse of blue sea on the farther verge. It was a tranquil and dreamy picture, beautiful to the eye. Talked together, and I had the idea of trying to reform Satan and persuade him to lead a better life. I told him about all those things he had been doing and begged him to be more considerate and stop making people unhappy. I said I knew he meant no harm, but that he ought to stop and consider the consequences of a thing before launching it in that impulsive and random way of his. Then he would not make so much trouble. He was not hurt by this plain speech. He only looked amused and surprised and said, "I stop and consider possible consequences? Where is the need? I know what the consequences are going to be. Always." "Well, Satan, then how could you do these things?" I queried. "Well, I will tell you, and you must understand if you can. You belong to a singular race. Every man is a suffering machine and a happiness machine combined. The two functions work together harmoniously with a fine and delicate precision on the give-and-take principle. For every happiness turned out in the one department, the other stands ready to modify it with a sorrow or a pain, maybe a dozen. In most cases, the man's life is about equally divided between happiness and unhappiness. When this is not the case, the unhappiness predominates, always. Sometimes a man's make and disposition are such that his misery machine is able to do nearly all the business. Such a man goes through life nearly ignorant of what happiness is. Everything he touches, everything he does, brings a misfortune upon him. You've seen such people. To that kind of person, life is not an advantage. It's only a disaster. Sometimes, for an hour's happiness, a man's machinery makes him pay years of misery. Don't you know that? It happens every now and then. I'll give you a case or two presently. Now, the people of your village are nothing to me. You know that, don't you? I did not speak out too flatly, so I said I had suspected it. Well, it's true that they are nothing to me. It's not possible that they should be. The difference between them and me is abysmal, immeasurable. They have no intellect. No intellect? I asked. Nothing that resembles it. Men have nothing in common with me. They have foolish little feelings and foolish little vanities and impertinences and ambitions. Their foolish little life is but a laugh, a sigh, and extinction. They have no sense, only their moral values. I'll show you what I mean. Here's a red spider, not so big as a pin's head. Can you imagine an elephant being interested in him? Caring whether he is happy or isn't, or whether he's wealthy or poor, or whether his sweetheart returns his love or not, or whether his mother is sick or well, or whether he's looked up to in society or not, or whether his enemies will suit him or his friends desert him, or whether his hopes will suffer blight and his political ambitions fail, or whether he shall die in the bosom of his family or neglected and despised in a foreign land. These things can never be important to the elephant. They are nothing to him. He cannot shrink his sympathies to the microscopic size of them. Man is to me as the red spider is to the elephant. The elephant has nothing against the spider. He cannot get down to that remote level. I have nothing against man. The elephant is indifferent. I am indifferent. The elephant would not take the trouble to do the spider an ill turn. If he took the notion, he might do him a good turn, if it came his way and cost nothing. I have done man good service, but no ill turns. The elephant lives a century, the red spider a day. In power, intellect, and dignity, the one creature is separated from the other by a distance which is simply astronomical. Yet in these, as in all qualities, man is immeasurably further below me than is the wee spider below the elephant. Man's mind clumsily, tediously, and laboriously patches little trivialities together and gets a result, such as it is. My mind creates. Do you get the force of that? Creates anything it desires, and in a moment. Creates without material. Creates fluids, solids, colors, anything, everything, out of the airy nothing which is called thought. A man imagines a silk thread, imagines a machine to make it, imagines a picture, then by weeks of labor embroiders it on a canvas with a thread. I think the whole thing, and in a moment, it's before you, created. I think a poem, music, the record of a game of chess, anything, and it's there. It's the immortal mind. Nothing is beyond its reach. Nothing can obstruct my vision. The rocks are transparent to me. The darkness is daylight. Nothing goes on in the skull of man, bird, fish, insect, or other creatures which can be hidden from me. I pierce the learned man's brain with a single glance, and the treasures which cost him 60 years to accumulate are mine. He can forget, and he does forget. I retain. Now then, I perceive by your thoughts that you are understanding me fairly well. So let's proceed. Circumstances might so fall out that the elephant could like the spider, supposing he can see it. But he could not love it. His love is for his own kind, for his equals. An angel's love is sublime, adorable, divine, beyond the imagination of man. But it is limited to his own august order. If it fell upon one of your race for only an instant, it would consume its object to ashes. No, we cannot love men, but we can be harmlessly indifferent to them. We can also like them, sometimes. I like you and the boys. I like Father Peter, and for your sakes, I'm doing all these things for the villagers. He saw that I was thinking a sarcasm, and he explained his position. Your race never knows good fortune from ill. They are always mistaking the one for the other. It's because they cannot see into the future. What I am doing for the villagers will bear good fruit some day, in some cases to themselves, in others to unborn generations of men. No one will ever know that I was the cause, but it will be none the less. Among you boys, you have a game. You stand a row of bricks on end a few inches apart, and you push a brick. It knocks its neighbor over. The neighbor knocks over the next brick, and so on till the row is prostrate. That is human life. Each act unfailingly begets an act. That act begets another, and so on to the end. And the seer can look forward down the line and see just when each act is to have birth, from cradle to grave. Does God order the career? I asked. Fordain it? No.
The man's circumstance and environment order it. His first act determines the second and all that follows after. But suppose, for argument's sake, that the man should skip one of these acts, an apparent trifling one, for instance. Suppose that it had been appointed that on a certain day, at a certain hour and minute, and second and fraction of a second, he should go to the well, and he didn't go. That man's life would change utterly. For instance, if at any time, say in boyhood, Columbus had skipped the most trifling link in the chain of acts projected and made inevitable by his first act, it would have changed his whole subsequent life, and he would have become a priest and died obscure in an Italian village, and America would not have been ravaged for 2 centuries afterwards. I know this. I've examined his billions of possible careers, and in only one of them occurs the discovery of America. You people do not suspect that all your acts are of one size and importance, but it is true. To snatch at an appointed fly is as big with fate for you as is any other appointed act. Now then, no man ever does drop a link. The thing has never happened. Even when he is trying to make up his mind as to whether he will do a thing or not, that itself is a link, an act, and has its proper place in his chain. You see now that a man will never drop a link in his chain. He can't. That project itself will be an unavoidable link, a thought bound to occur to him at the precise moment and made certain by the first act of his life. It all seems so dismal. He's a prisoner for life, I said with sorrow. He cannot get free? No, but I can free him. I looked up wistfully. I have changed the careers of a number of your villagers. I tried to thank him, but found it difficult, and let it drop. I shall make some other changes. You know that little Lisa Brandt? Oh, yes, everybody does. My mother says she is so sweet and so lovely that she is not like any other child. She says she will be the pride of the village when she grows up. I will change her future, he stated. Make it better, I asked. Yes, and I will change the future of your friend Nicholas. I was glad this time and said, I don't need to ask about his case. You will sure to do generously by him. It is my intention, Satan replied. Straight off, I was building that great future of Nicky's into my imagination, and had already made a renowned general of him and Hofmeister at the court, when I noticed that Satan was waiting for me to get ready to listen again. I was ashamed of having exposed my cheap imaginings to him, and was expecting some sarcasms, but it didn't happen. He proceeded with his subject. Nicky's appointed life is 62 years. That's grand, I said. Lisa's 36. But as I told you, I shall change their lives and those ages. 2 minutes and a quarter from now, Nicholas will wake out of sleep and find the rain blowing in. It was appointed that he should turn over and go to sleep again. But I have appointed that he shall get up and close the window first. That trifle will change his career entirely. He will rise up in the morning 2 minutes later than the chain of his life had appointed him to rise. By consequence, nothing will ever happen to him in accordance with the details of the old chain of events. He took out his watch and sat looking at it a few moments, then said, Nicholas has risen to close the window. His life has changed. His new career has begun. There will be consequences. It made me feel kind of creepy. It was uncanny. Satan went on. But for this change, certain things would happen 12 days from now. For instance, Nicholas would save Lisa from drowning. He would arrive on the scene at exactly the right moment, 10:04, the long-ago appointed instant of time, and the water should be shoal, the achievement easy and certain. But he will arrive some seconds too late now. Lisa will have struggled into deeper water. He will do his best, but both will drown. Oh, Satan, Satan, I cried with tears rising in my eyes. Save them. Don't let this happen. I can't bear to lose Nicholas. He's my loving playmate and friend, and think of Lisa's poor mother. I clung to him and begged and pleaded, but he was not moved. He made me sit down again and told me I must hear him out. I've changed Nicholas's life, and this has changed Lisa's. If I had not done this, Nicholas would save Lisa. Then he would catch cold from his drenching. One of your race's fantastic and desolate scarlet fevers would follow, with pathetic after effects. For 46 years, he would lie in his bed, a paralytic log, deaf, dumb, blind, and praying night and day for the blessed relief of death. Shall I change his life back? I stopped. Oh, no. In charity and pity, leave it as it is. It is best so, Satan went on. I could not have changed any other link in his life and done so good a service. He had a billion possible careers, but none of them was worth living. They were charged full with miseries and disasters. But for my intervention, he would do this brave deed 12 days from now, a deed begun and ended in 6 minutes, and get for all reward of those 46 years of sorrow and suffering. It is one of the cases I was thinking of a while ago when I said that sometimes an act which brings the actor an hour's happiness and self-satisfaction is paid for or punished by years of suffering. I wondered what poor little Lisa's early death would save her from. He answered the thought. From 10 years of pain and slow recovery from an accident, and then from 19 years pollution, shame, depravity, crime, ending with death at the hands of the executioner. 12 days hence she will die. Her mother would save her life if she could. Am I not kinder than her mother? Yes, I replied, indeed yes, and wiser. Father Peter's case is coming on presently. He will be acquitted through unassailable proofs of his innocence. Why, Satan, how can that be? Do you really think it? Indeed, I know it. His good name will be restored, and the rest of his life will be happy. I can believe it, I said. To restore his good name will have that effect. In my mind, and modestly, I asked for the particulars, but Satan paid no attention to my thought. Next, my mind wandered to the astrologer, and I wondered where he might be. On the moon, said Satan, with a fleeting sound, which I believe was a chuckle. I've got him on the cold side of it, too. He doesn't know where he is, and he's not having a pleasant time. Still, it's good enough for him. A good place for his star studies. I shall need him presently, then I shall bring him back and possess him again. He has a long and cruel and odious life before him, but I will change that, for I have no feeling against him, and am quite willing to do him a kindness. I think I shall get him burned. Satan had such strange notions of kindness, but angels are made so, and know no better. Their ways are not like our ways, and besides, human beings are nothing to them. They think we are only freaks. I held out my hand and said, "The light lies upon us. Think it into a glass of wine, Satan." He did it. I drank the wine. "Come along, I have business. I'll put you to bed." Said and done. Then he was gone, but his voice came back to me through the rain and darkness, saying, "Yes, tell Seppi, but no other." It was the answer to my thought. Sleep would not come. My mind was filled with Nicholas and the good days we had seen together at romps and frolics in the woods and the fields and the river in the long summer days and skating and sliding in the winter when our parents thought we were in school. And now he was going out of his young life. His place would be vacant. We should see him no more. As the years of our comradeship came back to me, my memories were mainly of cases where I had wronged or hurt him. And my heart was wrung with remorse. Once, when we were 9 years old, he went on a long errand of nearly 2 miles for the fruiter, who gave him a splendid big apple as a reward. As he was running home with it, I met him, and he let me look at the apple. I grabbed it and ran off with it, eating it as I ran, and he followed me and begging, and when he overtook me, I offered him the core, which was all that was left, and I laughed. Then he turned away crying, and said he had meant to give it to his little sister. That took me, for she was slowly getting well of a sickness. It would have been a proud moment for him to see her joy. But I was ashamed to say I was ashamed, and only said something rude and mean, to pretend I didn't care. He made no reply in words, but there was a wounded look in his face as he turned away, which rose before me many times in after years, in the night, and made me ashamed again. It had grown dim in my mind by and by, but it was back now. And not dim. No, I couldn't sleep. Shabby wrongs upbraided me and tortured me. The wind was still moaning about the eaves, the rain still pattering on the panes. In the morning, I sought out Seppi and told him. His lips moved, but he didn't say anything. He only looked dazed and stunned, the tears welling into his eyes, and then he turned away, and I locked my arm in his, and we walked along thinking, but not speaking. and so it gave us a shock when we made a bend and came upon Nicholas, face to face. He shouted gaily, Hey, what's the matter? Have you seen a ghost? We couldn't speak, but it was no matter. He was willing to talk for us all, for he had just seen Satan and was in high spirits. Satan had told him about our trip to China, and he had begged Satan to take him on a journey, and Satan had promised. It was to be a far journey, and wonderful and beautiful, and Nicholas had begged him to take us too, but he said no. He would take us some day, maybe, but not now. Satan would come for him on the 13th, and Nicholas was already counting the hours. That was the fatal day. We were counting the hours too. Our tone toward Nicholas was so strangely gentle that he noticed it, and he was pleased. We were constantly doing him deferential courtesies and saying, Wait, let me do that for you. I gave him 7 fish hooks, all I had, and made him take them. Seppi gave him his new knife and a humming top painted red and yellow, atonements for swindles practiced upon him formerly, as I learned later. We parted at last. He was radiant and said he had never had such a happy day. The next day and every day we spent all of our spare time with Nicholas, and also added at the time which we, and he, stole from work and other duties, and this cost the 3 of us some sharp scoldings and some threats of punishment. Every morning, 2 of us woke with a start and a shudder as the days flew by. The most distressing thing was that he was always making plans, and it made us groan in spirit. All his mind was fixed upon finding some way to conquer our depression and cheer us up, and at last, when he had but 3 days to live, he fell upon the right idea and was jubilant over it. A boys and girls frolic and dance in the woods, up where we first met Satan, and this was to occur on the 14th. It was ghastly, for that was his funeral day. We couldn't venture to protest. It would only raise a question which we couldn't answer. He wanted us to help him invite the guests, and we did. One can refuse nothing to a dying friend, but it was dreadful, for really, we were inviting them to his funeral. It was an awful 11 days, and yet, with a lifetime stretching back between today and then, they are still a grateful memory to me, and beautiful. In effect, they were days of companionship with one sacred dead, and I have known no such comradeship that was so close or so precious. We clung to the hours and the minutes, counting them as they wasted away, and parting with them with that pain and bereavement which a miser feels who sees his hoard filched from him coin by coin by robbers and is helpless to prevent it. When the evening of the last day came and we stayed out too long, Seppi and I were in fault for that. We couldn't bear to part with him. So it was very late when we left him at his door. We lingered a while listening, and his father gave him the promised punishment, and we heard his shrieks. But we listened only a moment and hurried away. Sorry for the father, too, if he only knew. In the morning, Nicholas did not meet us at the appointed place, so we went to his home to see what the matter was. His mother said, His father is all out of patience with these goings on, and will not have any more of it. Half the time when Nick is needed, he's not to be found. Then it turns out he's been out gadding around with you two. His father gave him a flogging last night. He appealed to me in vain, for I'm out of patience myself. I wish you had saved him just this one time, I said, my voice trembling. Seppi asked if Nicholas might go out with us. I'm sorry, she answered, but he can't. To punish him further, his father won't allow him out of the house today. We had great hope. I saw it in Seppi's eyes. We thought, if he can't leave the house, he can't be drowned. Seppi asked to make sure. Must he stay in all day or only the morning? All day. It's such a pity, too. It's such a beautiful day, but he's busy planning his party, and maybe that's company for him. Seppi asked if we might go up and help him pass the time. She said heartily, Now I call that friendship. When you might be in the woods having a time, you are good boys. I'll allow that. The first thing we noticed when we entered Nicholas's room was the time, 9:45. Only such a few minutes to live. I felt a contraction in my heart. Nicholas jumped up and gave us a glad welcome. He was in good spirits over his plannings for the party and had not been lonesome. Sit down, he said, and look what I've been doing. And I finished a kite that you will say is a beauty. It's drying in the kitchen. I'll fetch it. He had been spending his penny savings on various trifles as game prizes, and they were set upon the table. He said, Look these over while I get Mother to touch up the kite with her iron. Then he tripped out and went clattering downstairs, whistling. We did not look at the things. We couldn't take any interest in anything but the clock. We sat staring at it in silence, listening to the ticking. Finally, Seppi drew a breath, and I said, 9:50. 7 minutes more, and he will pass the death point. Theodore, he's going to be saved. Hush, I spoke. Watch the clock. Keep still. 5 minutes more. We were panting with the strain and the excitement. Another 3 minutes, and there was a footstep on the stair. Saved, and we jumped up and faced the door. The old mother entered, bringing the kite. Isn't it a beauty, she said. And dear me, how he has slaved over it, ever since daylight, I think, and only finished it a while before you came. She stood it against the wall and stepped back to take a view of it. He drew the pictures himself. They are very good. He asked me to bring it up. Dear me, it's 7 past 10, and I... But where is he? We blurted out. He'll be here soon. He's gone out a minute. Gone out? Just as he came downstairs, little Lisa's mother came in and said the child had wandered off somewhere, and she was a bit uneasy. I told Nicholas to go and look her up. Why, how white you two look. I believe you're sick. Sit down. I'll fetch you something. And she disappeared. We hurried to the back window and looked toward the river. There was a great crowd at the other end of the bridge, and people were flying toward the point from every direction. Oh, it is all over now. Poor Nicholas. Why, oh, why did she let him out of the house? Come away, said Seppi, half sobbing. We can't bear to stay. In 5 minutes she'll know. But we were not to escape. She came upon us at the foot of the stairs with her cordials in her hand and made us come in and sit down and take the medicine. Then she watched the effect. It didn't satisfy her. She made us wait a little longer. Presently the thing happened which we were dreading. There was a sound of tramping outside, and a crowd came solemnly in with heads covered and laid the two drowned bodies on the bed. Oh, my God, that poor mother cried out and fell on her knees and put her arms around her dead boy and began to cover the wet face with kisses. It was I that sent him, and I have been his death. If I had obeyed and kept him in the house, this would not have happened. I was cruel to him last night, and him begging me, his own mother, to be his friend. And so she went on, and all the women cried and pitied her and tried to comfort her, but she could not forgive herself. It could not be comforted. It shows how foolish people are when they blame themselves for anything they've done. Nothing happens that your first act hasn't arranged. And so, of your own motion, you can't alter the scheme or do a thing that will break a link. Next we heard scream, and Frau Brandt came wildly plowing and plunging through the crowd with her dress in disorder and her hair flying loose, and flung herself upon her dead child, moans and kisses and pleadings and endearments, and by she rose up, almost exhausted with her outpourings of passionate emotion, and she clenched her fist and lifted it toward the sky, and her tear-drenched face grew hard and resentful, and she said, "For nearly 2 weeks I have had dreams and premonitions and warning that death was going to strike that most precious to me, and day and night and night and day I have groveled in the dirt before him, praying him to have pity on my innocent child and save it from harm, and here is his answer. His hard heart has no compassion. I will never pray again." She gathered her dead child to her bosom and strode away, the crowd falling back to let her pass and smitten dumb by the awful words they had heard. Oh, that poor woman. It is as Satan said. We do not know good fortune from bad and are always mistaking one for the other. Many a time since, I've heard people pray to God to spare the life of sick persons. But I have never done it. You've been listening to a radio adaptation of The Mysterious Stranger, written by Mark Twain. My name is Scooter, and this has been The Inner Side, produced at KPFT Houston.
And our website is www.unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening to Unwelcome Guests.